The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week, we look at the shortlist for this year's Royal Society Winton Prize for Science books, including Stuff Matters, The Strange Stories of the Marvellous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World, and Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. Also on the show, we have our picks from the week's science news, including the upcoming attempt to land a European space probe on a speeding comet, and Fabiola Giannotti, who led one of the teams that discovered the Higgs boson, will be the new leader of the CERN Particle Physics Lab near Geneva. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio, we have Professor Nikki Clayton, a Cambridge cognitive neuroscientist and chair of the judges of the 2014 Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books, and Robin McKee, the Observer's Science and Technology Editor. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nikki, before we discuss what the judges were looking for this year, let me just zip through the shortlisted titles. It'll take me a moment. They are Serving the Reich, The Struggle for the Soul of Physics Under Hitler by Philip Ball, Seven Elements That Have Changed the World by John Brown, The Perfect Theory by Pedro Ferreira, The Cancer Chronicles by George Johnson, Stuff Matters, The Strange Stories of the Marvellous Materials That Shape Our Man-Made World by Mark Meadovnik, and finally Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal by Mary Roach. And I should say that the first chapter of each is available to download free from the Royal Society's website. So, Nikki, that's the shortlist. Was it a strong year for popular science books this year, do you think?
I think it was a very strong year, and it's a big ask. We actually had about 44 books to have a look at and decide which ones. And these were the six that really stood out to the panel of judges.
What were the judges looking for?
Something really inspiring, a book that's about proper hardcore science, but written really clearly so anybody can understand it. And a book you don't want to put down, you want to read more. I suppose for me the biggest test is if I read a book on a subject I don't know much about and I end up at the end of it feeling, wow, I had no idea that was so interesting. Gosh, if I'd had my turnaround, perhaps I should have done a degree in that. That to me is a brilliant test. So that's what I was looking for. Tough ask.
What are the kinds of things that the judges brought out as things they particularly enjoyed about this collection of six books? Any particular themes or styles of writing that came out?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. There was some debate about whether some books were written particularly well or clearly, or where bits were under-explained or over-explained. So that did form part of our discussion. And the other part of the discussion really was about what things we found interesting and why, and how the ideas were presented.
What do people hate?
I think anybody that writes in a really patronising way. I won't mention names of ones.
But were there other niggles that came out where on these judging panels you get down some nitty gritty and there will be things that individual judges will say, I can't abide this or this? Just it's interesting for people to know the sorts of things that bug judges, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I think writing style was one of the things that annoyed us. We had quite different views on some of them. In fact, I formed a panel. We had a big long table and we had the ones that we loved, the ones that we all hated. So we sort of had ones, if we all liked them, then they were going to go forward to be seriously considered. If nobody liked them or only one person liked them, unless the one person that liked it could really make a strong case for it, it was out. And then, of course, it was the ones in the middle. And I had two categories. I had the Marmites, the ones some people love and others hate. And I had the mushy peas, where everybody's kind of like, well, it's all right, but nothing special. And our goal as judges was to make sure that we didn't have too many that were being considered that were in the mushy peas category.
But a couple of Marmites there.
There were a couple of Marmites.
Robin, what did you make of this year's shortlist?
I think it's a very, very good list this year. And there are several books there that I really enjoyed. Obviously, the one that I particularly liked was Stuff Matters, which I recommended my last year's Science Books of the Year. So I don't know what it's doing in this year's Science Books of the Year for Royal Society. The way you're going, you're going to give Origin of the Species the 2016 award. presumably the wheels have, you know, grind a bit slow there. It's a marvellous book about the way that the materials that we make shape our world. And I particularly like, there's a chapter, basically, what the Romans ever done for us. You go through the materials chapter and you think, wow, this is what they did for us. There's this great story of a fortress found in up in the Antonine Wall, and it had been abandoned because, you know, nasty hordes of Scots were kind of beginning to wade down on this fort. So they dismantled it log by log, and they buried every single nail they had. And there was like 750,000 normal nails, 100,000 small nails, and 80,000 big nails, and they buried the lot so the Scots couldn't get them and turn them into weapons. And then they went south carrying all the rest of the metal they had, including their razors, which they used to shave every day to make sure they weren't confused with nasty, hairy Scots. And you go through this, and the other things the Romans did, they made these beautiful glass goblets. Until then, wine was drunk out of metal goblets and you couldn't see. The Romans made these beautiful wine glasses that you could see through, and suddenly, you know, you got this the need for quality wines that were clear and sharp. So the whole wine industry got a boost out of that. The Chinese never really got a grasp of glass. The Romans had it and gave it to the Europeans. And of course, that gave us the expertise to turn things and make telescopes and microscopes. And that gives us, you know, all the technological scientific advantages that turn Europe into this sort of fulcrum of society. So you can see it's all coming from stuff, all coming from materials. Thought the way of looking at the world that I'd never thought of, I thought it was marvellous, absolutely marvellous.
A glowing report. What other books of on the shortlist did you read?
Well, Philip Bowles, Serving the Reich, and, you know, Philip is a great science writer, and he...
I think he's won before as well. I think he's won this prize
before.
Yeah,
nobody likes a smart aleck.
he's a legend, though.
He's a prolific legend, and you know, he thoroughly deserves to be in any shortlist. And this is a particularly corrosive of what it says about Heisenberg and his role in developing the atomic bomb, or not developing the atomic bomb. Philip makes it quite clear that Heisenberg, he was supposed to... He always... His defence was, I knew how to make a bomb, but I made sure that Hitler didn't get it by doing these things, making sure it never happened. Quite false, quite a bit of secondary revision. In fact, he didn't twig it at all and was dumbfounded that all these ignorant non-Aryan, non-Germans had made an atom bomb and Germany hadn't. He was, you know, thoroughly nasty bit of works as he comes out of this. So, I mean, it's an intriguing book in it as well.
And the other one was?
Cancer Chronicles.
Right, okay.
Which is a very touching book written about George Johnson's partner, Nancy, who gets cancer. It's got a happy ending, so. And he goes through looking at cancer, what are the risks involved, with a very, you know, very intriguing aspects of cancer and our risks to come out of that book.
Nikki, there's another physics book on here. We've got The Perfect Theory, The Story of General Relativity by Pedro Ferreira. What did you make of that one?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting book, and I think we saw quite a lot of physics books this year. 2014 seems to be a good year for various aspects of physics, something to do with Einstein, I gather. And I think that was probably the best of the books about that. It was written with such passion, you know, it's somebody who obviously it's totally obsessed and wants to share his knowledge and his love of the subject with others. And that's always inspiring and makes a very good book.
We've talked about Philip Ball as being one of these prolific science writers. Mary Roach is on the shortlist as well, who's cracked out a good few books and always lovely ones. Gulp Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, which I must admit I haven't read, but I've heard good things about. What did you make of that?
Well,
Nikki?
It's such an interesting book. She uses humour so cleverly. You know, you're reading about things like, I mean, I did feel a bit kind of queasy at one point when I was reading about Elvis's poo. But she uses humour.
Elvis's poo?
Elvis's poo, amongst other things, yeah. I'm not going to say too much because I want people to read it and be intrigued. You know,
is that because he died on the toilet? It is, isn't it?
The last preserve of...
Well, don't you remember the royals?
Exactly. And she's done such a thorough job, you know. Huh? She went round interviewing all these different people and investigating all these different things. It was absolutely fascinating read, and at times so funny. There were times when I just couldn't stop laughing. There's one bit as well where she's busy looking at the rectum, and she goes and interviews all these people about what are called apparently prison wallets in the US, and the whole idea that, you know, people will stuff up their private parts to hide things, and she did all this incredible detective work about it, and I was just in absolute stitches.
I'm lost. Can you elaborate, or I won't say demonstrate, but can you elaborate more about
what? Well, it's
what?
About the,
you're just
the
playing hard to get,
aren't you? That the alimentary canal can be a criminal accomplice. It's what's called a prison's wallet, apparently.
Prison.
And you can stuff pencil sharpeners and sharpener blades and all kinds of things, apparently.
I do remember.
I have no idea out there.
It's one way of getting your earwax out, isn't it?
There was a paper in a medical journal some time ago, which I remember writing about, I think when I was still on a college newspaper, and it was a list of things that doctors had retrieved from patients'
rectums.
Rectums, through there, that area.
That bit, down there.
They involved a magazine, and the one I remember, weirdly, was spectacles. Can you imagine they wouldn't survive the process? But it's a clearly an extraordinary topic. For a book which I look forward to reading. We haven't talked about John Brown's book, Lord Brown's book, former CEO of BP, Seven Elements.
Yeah.
There are a lot of books about things that have changed the world or are purported to have changed the world.
So it was an interesting take, really. He sort of began by sort of saying that there's something special about the number seven, that seven has all kinds of significances. That was quite interesting, and it brought me back because a couple of years ago now I worked with Ron Baer, then the dance company, on Seven for a Secret, Never to be Told, where we also explored the sort of magical properties of seven. That was really about children and play. But he used it to select seven elements that he thought had really changed the world: iron, copper, gold, silver, uranium, titanium and silicon. And it's a very interesting book, and it's got a nice structure, because for each of these seven, he then goes through why these elements have been so important. And he talks about the discovery of graphene and how you could get a sheet of carbon that's just one atom thick, even though it's 300 times stronger than steel and all that sort of thing. So that was a very good book. But I have to say that my favourite was Stuff Matters, which is on a similar topic, but it starts so powerfully. I mean, how many science books start with a stabbing?
And not enough, I think. Is
and I think and a stabbing of the author himself.
Stabbing of the author himself. You know, most people would have just taken that away as a horrendous experience that they wanted to block from their memory and try their best to forget. But not Mark. Instead, you know, he develops a fascination with steel, and he talks about the stainless steel razor blade that did the dirty deed, so to speak, and then the fascination afterwards with the staple that was bound to the questionnaire he had to fill in at the police station afterwards. So, and there were so many interesting and inspiring bits about it. There was even a chapter on chocolate. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's made me realise you shouldn't bite into chocolate too quickly. You're supposed to leave it in your mouth and let it melt a bit first, and then it gives you all these other kinds of sensations, apparently.
And then some malt whiskey afterwards. It's a fantastic mix. Yeah.
Sounds great, doesn't it? Yeah.
There are different approaches in the books that you've got in the shortlist. You've got people like Mark, the expert, coming to their field and writing about their field. You have essentially journalist writers like Mary Roach and Philip Ball, who, I mean, Mary Roach very much uses the style of her taking the reader on a journey and going around interviewing all these people and taking the reader with her. And Philip doing probably more sort of historical takes and such like. How do you see these in terms of how they compete? Are they equally enjoyable, or do you find one approach more convincing or more enjoyable than others?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think both perspectives are interesting. I mean, Philip Ball's book is very insightful and powerful, and it really brings sort of the interplay of science and politics to life. And one of the things is you really get a sense of the characters of these people and the conflicts and moral and ethical turmoil brought to life. And then you get Mary Roach, who's, it is very serious, but it's continually infused with humour. So, you know, I wasn't giggling throughout Philip Ball's book, whereas Mary Roach's book, I was in stitches. And then, you know, the Cancer Chronicles wow, well, that was another amazing book for me. I mean, it's almost like there's two writers within the one book, and they're interwoven together so beautifully that I don't mean two different voices that curdle one another, but two very different, like a yin and a yang, because there's the one that's this very detailed, insightful investigation of what exactly cancer is, how it works, what the mechanisms are, dispelling some of the silly myths, like, you know, if you eat fruit and vegetables, you'll be fine and don't have to worry about cancer evermore. And yet there's this other side of him, which is the journalist with a partner who's been diagnosed with this terrible disease. And there are some very sad and emotional bits in there. And a few surprises. I don't want to say what the surprise is, because I don't want to spoil it for the reader, but some great, some sad, and very emotional, and they're all different.
It strikes me as a list that's got a lot of professional writers in it, predominantly, rather than a lot of scientists writing about their subject. And I think it's all stronger for that, because it's, you know, the books are all really structured carefully. They're not overwritten. They're not too much talking down. And equally, there's not too much obscure and, you know, often quite kind of lumping prose in there that I think has bedeviled previous lists.
I was going to say, Robin, you're not one to hold your tongue when you have a bugbear about something. Is there anything in this list, or even extrapolating to science books around at the moment? What are your sort of pet niggles?
Well, I suppose actually what they do wrong is they try to popularise too much, basically. There's too much sort of, I don't know, trying to be different and trying desperately to get the attention of an agent and a publisher by writing something. And, you know, it becomes just a little bit too gimmicky. And none of these books I would call for a second gimmicky, but you could imagine in the wrong hands, something like Stuff Matters could have been gimmicky. It most certainly isn't. It's very much the opposite. Fabulous book, as I've said. But there's an awful lot of gimmicks and sort of lightheartedness in science books at the moment that we could really do without.
Yeah. Verbal diarrhea is my other pet peeve. Yeah. There were some books, not these ones, not on the shortlist, thank goodness, but some of the other books, you know, I just felt they were good in places, and then you're like, why have you gone on and on and on about this? And it's, you know, taking the power away, because there's all this guff and extraneous stuff that somebody should have deleted before it became the book.
Oh, well, I mean, I suppose that's that is the real thing. In the terms of publishing, there are really, books are not properly edited the way they were 20, 25 years ago. And you see stuff in there, you think, why is this here? Why wasn't an editor, copy editor there, taking it out? The copy editors aren't there anymore. Publishers are just down to their last, you know, two work experience people and slinging it out. And it shows.
I did want to ask both of you about the sort of diversity of this prize. I mean, it's very dominated by men and white men at that. It's never been won by a woman. I'm not assuming there's anything going on at the judging stage. I presume it's something to do with the books that are coming to the judges. But give me your thoughts. Why has there never been a female winner of this prize?
Well, I don't know. I can only speak in my role this year. But the vast majority of the books that we assessed, the authors were male. There wasn't the opportunity to select.
But why would that be, do you think?
I suppose the vast majority of science is just dominated by men still. I mean, it's getting better, but how quickly, you have to say. But it's still a male-dominated topic. Mm.
But science journalism, much less so.
Said the two science journalists in the room being male, yeah. Keep going.
If I look back to where I came through from New Scientist and, you know, looking around, you know, more broadly than just The Guardian.
But you've always been an alpha malian.
There are a lot of women in science writing and science journalism. And
much more so, yeah.
Robin, with all your vast experience in this field, what do you think would make the ideal science book?
Was Santa an astronaut? Reindeer of the Gods, I would call it. And Ross, and I would prove that Santa was actually an astronaut and an alien. And it's all down to that we've got Christmas today.
Nikki, you're not getting away with that question either.
We suddenly wake up and find that we're dominated by a planet of the crows. That would make a good story.
Right, there you go.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah.
And you can look out for those, I'm sure, on next year's shortlist. The Royal Society Winton Prize will be awarded on Monday evening, and you can find out more about that at theroyalsociety.org, and we shall certainly cover it at theguardian.com/science.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Let's look at some of the other science stories around this week. Robin, there's a change in directorship on the cards at CERN, the particle physics lab near Geneva, where the Higgs boson was discovered. What's afoot?
Well, yes, in 2016, Fabiola Giannotti is going to take over. She's a wonderful Italian physicist. Was the spokesperson for the ATLAS experiment, one of the two major experiments that, of course, pinpointed the Higgs 2 years ago, 2012. Remarkable person, really good, in contrast to lack of female science authors. We now have a woman in just about the top scientific job in the world. I can't think of anything better than head of CERN.
We had her as one of the 100 most important women that The Guardian chose last year. And certainly she is an extraordinary woman. I mean, one thing I very much liked about her sort of her history, if you like, is that she came from this education that was steeped in ancient Greek philosophy and history of art. And she trained as a pianist at the Milan Conservatory. But she then saw beauty in physics, became pretty obsessed by that, and she works incredibly hard and is incredibly passionate about her subject, as we've probably all seen, at least from her presentation when she showed that her group ATLAS at CERN had found evidence for the Higgs boson, had found the Higgs boson. And she said a very nice thing to CERN's in-house magazine some while before that, and she was saying, physics is unfortunately often seen as a male subject, sterile and without charm or emotion. And she said, but this isn't true because physics is art, aesthetics, beauty and symmetry. Mm. And you have what a lovely person to have at the head of the organisation and running it. And she just seems utterly inspirational to the people that she is over. I mean, certainly when she was heading the ATLAS team, this was a group of 3,000 scientists that she seemed to keep in sort of control and adoration of her. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I didn't find any in a long like many years of interviewing people on that group who had a bad word to say about her. So that's obviously wonderful news. So from January 2016, she should be the Director General of CERN, taking over from Rolf Hoyer, the fantastically charismatic also guy who's there at the moment.
And she's taken over at a time when the second tranche of the LHC upgrade, and you know, we had the first running of LHC, and you know, it was hoped to find the Higgs, and it found the Higgs, and now it's stepping kind of out into the unknown. Who knows what unusual and bizarre new things we're going to find? And it's, you know, it's great that she's going to be in charge, and we'll be explaining that to us when it comes.
I think it's going to be a tricky time though for the Large Hadron Collider, because, and for CERN, because you when they started up, they obviously had their initial problems with the LHC essentially blowing up and being set back a year or more. But then it had the target. It knew what it was going for in its first stretch of running at half energy. It knew it was going for the Higgs. It knew what the Higgs should look like. Now they're going, as you say, into this unknown territory where they know some interesting things to look for, but there is nothing sort of concrete, really, that they can be absolutely sure is, as near as damn it, to go for. And I think that then becomes trickier for making sure funders are paying and getting everybody on board, because you're sort of going off on a fishing expedition in some senses with the machine to try and see what else you can find. And that, I think, is going to be an interesting one politically. They will be characterising the Higgs and making some great measurements of that, but everyone will be wanting to know, what can you find beyond this standard model of particle physics? What is out there that's absolutely new? Because the Higgs was predicted in 1964,
so we've
known about it for 50 years. Well, from that to another European story. Robin, again, the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission has a major milestone coming up in the next few days. What's going on there?
The Rosetta mission has been circling Comet 67P. It's a 2.5-mile lump of cobbled together rock and rubble that is approaching the sun and will reach its perihelion in August. Before it gets too hot on the surface, it's going to drop a little lander called Philae on Wednesday. I mean, this is a mission that's got probably at best a 70% chance of success. Rosetta will stage itself right in front of the comet, i.e. between the sun and the comet, and then it will just release by matter of releasing little springs that will push out this little lander. It's about a metre across, a metre high, and it will gently head down over a distance of 18 kilometres at a speed of a few centimetres a second. Speed up when it gets near the comet, with the comet's gentle kind of gravitational field will pull it in. And provided it doesn't hit a surface that is more than 30% off the horizontal, or more than 30% off the horizontal, it shall stick down there, bolt itself into the surface, and begin a series of experiments that will, it will help tell us a lot of things. Rosetta is a major mission success already, but it will help us, how did comets form? How did the solar system form? Did comets bring water, and are they responsible for creating the oceans on Earth? And do the comets contain complex organics that are the building blocks of life? Did complex organics rain down on primitive Earth, and did life on Earth and ourselves evolve from that material? Fantastic set of questions to answer, and a fantastic mission. And this will be the icing on the cake, the cherry on the cake, if it works. But as somebody said, it'll be a very dusty, dirty cake, because this is basically, people used to think comets were dirty snowballs. In fact, they turn out to be snowy dirt balls from the look of this. But I mean, I can't wait for Wednesday. I pray that this one works. It's just fabulous.
It is a tough ask, though, isn't it? Mm. This comet is a pretty horrible shape for landing on. Everyone describes it as a kind of rubber duck type shape, yes, which basically means you've got one small blob joined to another larger blob. And whether they were actually two things that came together or one thing that's splitting apart, I'm not quite sure, but it's rotating obviously as it goes along, so it looks a horrible task.
12 different areas to land on, and most of them had to be kind of, no, you can't do that because it's too bumpy. And then they had a lovely smooth one, but the smooth one didn't face the sun enough and it wouldn't be able to charge up its solar panels. So it's a compromise at the head of the comet, on top of it's a head of the duck, and they're going to stick this comet, this lander on it, and hope it sticks.
One of the things I love about this, and I really hope that they succeed, is that it will, as you said, secure itself on the surface with these explosive harpoons and screws and whatnot. Yeah. Even though the electronics will die with time, it may be able to hold on to the comet long enough to do about 3 laps around the sun. And I think from memory, each lap takes about 6.5 years. So it's going to be this extraordinary little box of electronics on this comet, which is going out beyond Jupiter, as far as I recall, and coming back in, while Rosetta will have, you know, finished its job and all the rest of it. And they should, as you say, be able to learn an extraordinary amount about this comet, not least in one way by sending radio waves from the lander through to Rosetta through the comet, so it picks it up and almost gives it an X-ray or radio wave sort of impression of the material on there. It's a lovely thing.
I mean, they're already seeing them. The surface is ablating from the comet. When Rosetta arrived, it was like a cup of water per second coming off the surface. Now it's like about 5 litres of water coming off. And when...
billowing.
When it's finished, when it's done its kind of full sweep, an entire metre of the surface of the comet will have been sublimated off into space. And who knows what will be left standing around Philae as it's sort of anchored onto this piece.
And the European Space Agency is going for that landing on Wednesday. Do we know what time?
Kind of in the afternoon, we'll find out. It takes about 7 hours to make the descent.
Right, OK. And we'll have all of that covered again on theguardian.com/science. That's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Professor Nikki Clayton and Robin McKee. And from me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.